Tehran's startup scene today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Tehran, I met the founder of Iran's answer to Groupon, and she's got a message for Iranians in the diaspora.
I always say, whenever I see an Iranian outside, it's just like, look guys, we are the ones that are going to change this country. Otherwise, who's going to do it?
Also, China's latest provocative act in the South China Sea.
China has placed high-powered missiles in the middle of the world's most contested waters.
And if you're looking for ideas on how to immortalize your nation's strongman,
large bronze statues embalming. You know where to go. You go to North Korea.
Note taken. Those stories plus...
Oh, that's fantastic. It's a pirate umbrella. Isn't that great?
A tour of the London Underground's lost and found. That's all today here on The World. Iran is going through some big changes. A nuclear agreement with its longtime enemy, the United States, signals a start of Iran's return to the global economy. It's still early days, so it's hard to know how that's going to shake out. But as I found out with producer Matthew Bell during our trip to Tehran last week, people in the tech sector there are not waiting to see how things shake out. They're getting stuff done now. This first story in our series, Tehran Stories, is about a young woman who's behind a successful startup called Takfifan. This takes us to an upper middle class part of Tehran. The buildings here, mixed residential and commercial, are well constructed in sandstone and with large windows.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Nazanin. Matthew. How are you doing?
Nazanin.
Marco. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure.
Hi. How are you doing? Salam.
These are the offices of Takfifan, and that's Nazanin Daneshvar, the founder and brains behind the company. She's wearing a long black cardigan over a white blouse, and her hijab looks more fashionable than obligatory. Nazanin smiles a lot and speaks rapidly, as if she's got time for journalists, but she'd really rather stay focused on her business, Takfifan.
Takfif in Farsi means discount.
It's like Iran's version of Groupon. Takfifan brokers steep discounts with a variety of Tehran retailers for everything from sunglasses to candy to knockoff Starbucks coffee mugs. Consumers love the deals. Nazanin's business has seen 100% annual growth. It's not been a straight line to this achievement. After a stint as a technical team director in London, Nazanin's first go at a startup 6 years ago in Tehran was an online grocery delivery service.
My parents were living in a flat on the third floor, and they were just like carrying all this grocery stuff all the time. And I was just like, maybe we should do something similar to Europe. So I started the first online grocery shopping.
As that company was getting off the ground, Nazanin and her partner spoke with a Tehran journalist about the venture.
So basically what happened, we did the interview, and then suddenly the media picked us. And then we were on TV, we were on radio, we were on all the big brand newspapers. So in 1 hour, we got over 5,000 orders from everywhere in Tehran. And then I was just myself with one guy, a delivery guy, and I was just, oh my God, this is just not going to work.
Too much success, too fast. After that company crashed and burned, Nazanin left Iran again, this time for Germany. And that's where she got the idea to create an internet-based shopping service. Her previous experience suggested that managed right online shopping could work in Tehran, so she went home to set up what would become Takfifan. They set up shop in one corner of this four-story building a year ago. Now they've taken over the whole space, including the basement, which is set up as a warehouse for goods they sell, pushing beyond the original business model. In fact, last year, Nazanin Daneshvar was invited to the Silicon Valley for a tech conference where she met with a Groupon executive.
And then he was just like, I can't believe it, you're exactly copying us. And I was just like, I was just joking with him. I was just like, no, look, you are copying us. So the reality is like...
Regardless of who's copying whom, the reality is in Iran, Takfifan has taken off. Nazanin says the nuclear deal and the lifting of sanctions have been key.
We have been approached by tons of investors in the last couple of years, especially last year, because they could have felt like these changes are going to happen.
Last year, Takfifan was named one of the biggest startups founded by women in the Middle East region. Nazanin appreciates the recognition, but it doesn't suggest how challenging it is to be a woman in Iranian business culture today.
For example, if you would have come like an hour ago, we had a... head of a company that knows that the founder is a female in here. So they all came super religious, and they were not even looking at me while they were talking over the deal, you know. So this is quite normal. So I always take one of our male managers, and he always talks on our behalf, but that way I keep on fixing stuff. Obviously, there's a still, like, we have to deal with it, because you don't really see that many successful female managers, but I think hopefully through the years it will change.
And that change will accelerate, Nazanin believes, if more young, savvy Iranians like her who are living abroad will come home. Whenever she meets them, she tells them to move back.
Exactly. They should move back. They should. I always say, whenever I see an Iranian outside, it's just like, look, guys, we are the ones that are going to change this country. Otherwise, who's going to do it?
Before I left the Takfifan offices, Nazanin Daneshvar introduced me to some of her employees. Two quotes on the office walls in English jumped out at me, and both kind of summarize what it means to be a startup entrepreneur in Iran in 2016. One is from Gandhi and reads, "You must be the change you wish to see in the world." The other sign, hanging next to the desks of a couple of guys typing code, uses a four-letter word I can't use on air. It says, more or less, "Get stuff done." This week in Syria, four hospitals were bombed in a single day. Syrian rebels accused the Assad regime and Russian warplanes of intentionally targeting them, which would qualify as a war crime.
The situation inside Syria is a war without law and a war without end.
That's former British Foreign Secretary David Miliband. These days he heads the International Rescue Committee. The group's medical facilities in Syria were among those hit this week.
The French government have said that the attacks could constitute war crimes. That's one reason we're saying that there needs to be an immediate and comprehensive investigation of these bombing incidents and of the tactics associated with them. You said in your introduction that the bombing raids were being led by the Assad regime and by their Russian supporters. We have no evidence to contradict that. It seems obvious that that's the phase of the campaign that's currently underway. But obviously, we need to have proper confirmation and proper documentation. In terms of the design of this strategy, clearly there's an attempt to use the besiegement of cities as a way of conducting the war. That in itself constitutes a form of collective punishment for the people inside these besieged areas, who now total about 500,000 people right across Syria.
Traditionally, during wartime, hospitals are clearly marked so facilities can ensure safety and that safety be respected. Were the IRC facilities clearly marked?
All of our facilities are done in a fully transparent way. I think you're right to hint that the Syria war represents a new low in the way in which civilians are being placed in danger. It's not just that facilities are being hit. The Syria war has shown the targeting of doctors. This is something that various governments, including the Australian government, have tried to raise over the last 5 years. And there's been a refusal of the parties to recognize the need to protect doctors and other medical staff. So both on an individual level and on a community or collective level, there's been a refusal of the parties to the conflict to recognize the sanctity of medical aid. After the Second World War, the laws of war, international human rights law, was established. And it's vital that the gains that have been made are not thrown away, especially by a permanent member of the Security Council.
A guest on our program yesterday remarked that in the Arab world, it looks as though Washington is being played by Moscow, that Vladimir Putin agreed to a cessation of hostilities to begin this Friday so that Russia could have a week to bomb as it pleased. What do you think about that?
I think there's a widespread view, not confined to the Arab world, that the Western nations, led by the United States, but not confined to the United States, have been loath to get involved in what was originally seen as an internal matter within Syria, became a regional matter, now is a matter that consumes Europe, including its strongest country, Germany. There's been a very strong view from Washington and elsewhere that the last thing the US or other allies wanted was to get involved in this Middle East conflict. But the truth about the Middle East is that you may not want to go to the Middle East, but if you're not careful, the Middle East will come to you. And that's what's happened in Europe at the moment.
So back to the idea that Washington might be played by Moscow. Do you blame Washington for not holding Moscow to the spirit of this agreement?
A year ago, if you'd had me on this program, I would have said to you, look, the rise of ISIS creates an obvious common front or a common interest between the US and Russia. And I would have predicted, I confess to you, I would have predicted that there would have been more progress with the Russians. It's not been possible to make that progress. I don't think one can fault the administration for trying. They've made strenuous attempts over the last year to do so. But the Russians have judged their interests to be best served not by an accommodation or an agreement or a compromise with the US, but by the full engagement of their military strength since last September. And I think that we're stuck in a dialogue of the deaf, really, at the moment.
David Miliband with the International Rescue Committee, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Now to a big news story here in the U.S. The court order demanding Apple help the government to break into an iPhone and Apple's decision to fight that order. The order was issued by a federal judge, and the phone in question belonged to one of the shooters in that December attack in San Bernardino. It's a case that pits national security directly against people's privacy concerns. I asked David Kay about this. He teaches law at the University of California, Irvine, and he's also the UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Opinion and Expression. David, tell us what the FBI exactly wants from Apple and why Apple is fighting back.
The FBI is essentially asking for access to the contents of the phone. And the problem for the FBI is that the phone is password protected and Apple does not keep the password. The order itself that comes from the court is unusual in two respects. I mean, one, it seems to be asking Apple to create software that would be useful for this particular phone, but would be generally an approach that they would seek in the future. The other point about this case is that we're talking about the government using a law, the All Writs Act, that is from the 18th century. And we really haven't had a public policy or legal debate about what should be available to the government.
Yeah, what would be your position in a debate like that? I mean, is it logical that an 18th century law should be dictating law on a 21st century piece of technology?
No, absolutely not. The question is not whether the U.S. government has a legitimate interest in access to the information on this phone or access to information in national security context. I think the question rather is whether the tools that they're using will undermine security and privacy for all users in a way that is unacceptable.
I mean, the trade-off in the eyes of Apple CEO Tim Cook sounds kind of scary. He wrote that in the wrong hands as software, which does not exist today, would have the potential to unlock any iPhone in someone's physical possession. Do you think those risks are that serious?
I think there are very real risks here. If they're asked to create a backdoor or a key to provide access, that key would be, in essence, a master key to all phones that Apple creates.
So lay it out for us. Define encryption as Apple sees it, and why they feel it is all about freedom of expression.
Encryption scrambles the information between a sender and a receiver so that only the intended recipient can have access to that information. Everybody uses some form of encryption today, whether it's protecting the content of your messages on your smartphone or whether it's protecting your communication with your bank or with your healthcare provider. That kind of information is encrypted. Its privacy is protected.
Right. I mean, for bloggers in some parts of the world, encryption is a matter of life or death.
Absolutely. You know, in the digital age, our ability to search in some privacy is, in a way, a function of our ability to express ourselves, to develop our opinions. And while, you know, people in the United States may not see that as a real concrete threat, it's a threat to billions of people around the world who are in situations where the government really wants to know what you're searching, who you're talking to. That's a risk actually everywhere.
David Kay is a law professor at UC Irvine. He's also the UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Opinion and Expression. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. When we hear about refugees these days, we tend to think of the people fleeing the war in Syria and hoping for a new life in Europe. But the world's largest refugee camp is not in Europe or the Middle East. It's in Kenya. It's called Dadaab. The first residents arrived at the camp a quarter century ago in the early 1990s.
There was a civil war that ripped Somalia apart in the late 80s, early 90s, and the UN and the US tried to intervene. You may remember the Black Hawk Down incident of 1993. But there have been no real successful attempts to bring peace to Somalia since, and it's been more or less without a government. since that time.
That's Ben Rawlins, author of a book about the Dadaab refugee camp called City of Thorns. He's been there several times. Rawlins says Dadaab was supposed to be a temporary camp for 90,000 people, but the population there now is 500,000 because of the ongoing chaos and extremist violence in Somalia. And as he told my colleague Jeb Sharp, that even though Dadaab is as big as a city, it has no real infrastructure.
The Kenyan government doesn't allow permanent houses, doesn't allow permanent roads, no permanent power, no proper sanitation. So when the rains come, you have cholera epidemics, you have all kinds of health problems.
And you talk about hunger actually being a currency at the camp. What do you mean by that?
Well, people aren't allowed to work. This is one of the other restrictions that the Kenyan government imposes, and many governments do this. They don't allow asylum seekers and refugees to work and earn a living. And that means that they are reliant on the food rations, which are provided by the United Nations. But the food rations is only rice or sorghum or maize and beans. If you want tea or sugar, if you want vegetables, or maybe you want to buy some clothes in the market, you need cash. And the only way you can actually get cash, the only thing you can monetize, is your food. So people often go hungry, will sell their rations in order to buy luxuries or to diversify their diet. They'd rather have good food for a week and then go hungry for a week.
Ben Rawlins, you talk about the UN actually cutting rations at the camp. How is that possible?
Well, it's happened every year for the last 3 years, and that's because the UN is facing a funding crunch, partly because of the increased numbers in Syria, many more refugees around the world. I mean, I certainly thought it wasn't possible. I was shocked when I found out that it happened and that it has happened in the past as well. So people are actually dying as a result of those ration cuts. And to me, that's the biggest crime, the fact that you ask people to stay in this camp, you don't allow them to work, you don't allow them to leave, and then you don't feed them either. I mean, imagine if you put, you know, lock people up in a prison somewhere and then actually didn't feed the inmates. That would be a bit of a scandal, I think.
What's the trajectory and where are we headed with Dadaab?
Well, it's gotten worse and worse and worse as the camp has become more and more overcrowded and as donors have gotten very tired of funding it and the Kenyan government is losing patience and keeps saying that the camp should be closed. And then, of course, the security situation within Kenya has deteriorated, even as it has remained unstable in Somalia. It's getting worse in Kenya as al-Shabaab's making more and more incursions. And every time there's a terrorist attack in Kenya, the government starts blaming the refugees and calling for the camp to be closed again. So there's this sort of official movement to try and squeeze the refugees and make life harder and harder for them. And it is, to some extent, working. We are seeing a slow trickle of people going back into Somalia, back to the war, principally because conditions in the camp are so bad. You know, but it's not enough to sort of wipe the city, this city, which is actually the size of New Orleans. It's not enough to wipe that city off the face of the earth because there is a core population that has invested in businesses, you know, hotels and shops and cinemas and so on, and people who do not want to go back to Somalia under any circumstances. So I don't see an end to Dadaab anytime soon. I think that what we need to do is accept the permanence of these places, and Dadaab, of course, is one of many, and stop treating them as temporary. If you start with a permanent footing, and then you can begin to allow people to invest, to build lives that are a little more humane than this kind of the bare minimum of subsistence, which is what they have at the moment.
How do you get out of there? How do you go forward instead of back to Somalia?
There are very few legal routes out of the camp, which is partly why it's so big. One is to go back to Somalia into the war. One is to buy a Kenyan ID card or passport, but that's very expensive and very few people have that kind of money. The other way is to get resettled to the United States or to Europe, but that is a lottery and only 1,000 people a year get picked to go to the US and the birth rate in the camp is 1,000 a month. So there's very few people who actually can leave the camp through that legal route. And the last option is the illegal route. So Guled, one of the people in the book, the first character that appears, the first person I follow, at the end of the book, he is left considering walking to Europe because his options in the camp are so limited. He can't go back to Somalia because he was kidnapped by al-Shabaab. He's fearing revenge there. And he wants to provide for his wife, who's had children in the camp. And he says to me, you know, the only option for me as a man to try and provide for my wife. So I have to get to Italy or I have to die trying. That's the only honourable solution for me.
You also introduce us to Abdullah Hassan, nicknamed Fish. Tell us about him a little bit.
Fish has the most wonderful nickname. Somalis have a really great tradition of nicknames. And he was called Fish because his grandfather didn't like fish and yet ran a fish restaurant on the beach in southern Somalia, in a very beautiful place. He came when he was 7 years old and has been there ever since. Got married in the camp, had children in the camp, grew up his whole life in the camp, all the while expecting some sort of future outside the camp. So he went through primary school, secondary school, obtained diplomas by distance learning, mail order in the camp. And yet when he got to that sort of glass ceiling, aged 28, 29, 30, was then confronted with the fact that there was no future for him. And he, like several other people in his generation, they call themselves the 92 group, the class of 92, if you like, the people who came right at the beginning. They were very dynamic. Him and Tawane's other person formed youth groups, started running football leagues, soccer leagues, also were patrolling the camp when the al-Shabaab threat surfaced and there were attacks in the camp. They began organizing the refugees to run services when the UN was too scared. And then, of course, they became a target. So they started getting anonymous phone calls from al-Shabaab. Several of his colleagues in the community security team were murdered. So he ran away to Nairobi and tried to find some kind of safety there.
Ben Rawlins there, speaking with my colleague Jeb Sharp. Rawlins is the author of City of Thorns, a book about the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. Tomorrow, we meet Fish, the Somali refugee we were just hearing about.
I came to Dadaab in 1992 with my mother and two other siblings. We were six and three of them died.
What it was like growing up in the world's largest refugee camp, that's tomorrow, right here on The World. A music postcard from Iran as part of hashtag Tehran Stories. That's later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You never know what you might find left behind on a bus or train in London.
Crutches. Now, crutches fascinate me because I'm thinking you've got onto the bus or train with some crutches and then you've got off the other end not needing them. Is it some mysterious healing power of the London transport network?
That story's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. They may be tiny islands in the middle of the South China Sea, but China's territorial claims over them have the potential to spark some serious trouble. Today, tensions went up several notches in the region after news broke of the apparent deployment by China of surface-to-air missiles on an isolated outpost known as Woody Island. So, aggressive move by China, or is it within China's right, as it claims? For this, we turn to Patrick Nguyen with our partners at Global Post. What is going on here, Patrick? Just how provocative was this move by China?
Well, China has placed high-powered missiles in the middle of the world's most contested waters, and that's the South China Sea. Moreover, they're actually building a full-on operating base in the middle of the ocean. And so far, it's had troops, an artificial harbor, a huge runway that's fit for fighter jets, and now we have the introduction of extremely high-powered missiles that can blow just about anything out of the sky from about 125 miles away.
So that makes it all sound like China believes this is truly their territory. Who is disputing this area and how's it all playing out?
The island that is so well defended is claimed by Vietnam. I don't think that anyone thinks Vietnam is ever getting this island back. The overall sea is claimed by about eight countries, although China claims that the entire region belongs to China. They call it their blue national soil, and it's sort of an aquatic prefecture in the eyes of China. And we have to remember why China is defending this area so strongly. About half of the crude oil going to China from the Middle East is passing through these waters, about one-third of the world's shipping trade. So they have every reason to want to claim it for themselves, despite the brouhaha that this has generated.
So Woody Island, was this always a man-made island, or is it kind of started off as kind of a rock in the sea and China's built onto it?
Woody Island was always an island. Despite the fact that it's extremely small, it was one of the larger islands in the sea. China realized that and determined that it was going to be the seat of this aquatic prefecture that covers the entire sea. So it actually has government offices there. It considers it an administrative seat.
So does that mean that what they're doing is legal?
Whether it's legal or not depends on which side you're viewing it from. The U.S. doesn't think that it's legal, and the U.S. Navy tends to see itself as this great protector of the global shipping trade, and what China is doing is awful. China says it's had this area for many centuries, and it's always been under China's dominion.
It sounds like the importance of this whole area, it's not really what is valuable there, but just its strategic position, these oil routes, as you say.
Right. Oil routes. There's a lot of fishing throughout this region. There is natural gas buried beneath the sea, lucrative, giant, vast amounts of natural gas. But at this point, the focus seems to be on the fact that it's such a vital shipping route. If this area were denied to China, the economy would crumble. They simply wouldn't have crude oil flowing in to power the economy. So they think that it very much is in their interest to protect it. The U.S. and principally Vietnam and the Philippines disagree. And Vietnam and the Philippines, you know, their militaries are not nearly as powerful as the U.S. The U.S. has sort of stepped in as a de facto naval force protecting their interest.
Yeah, so what kind of reaction have we gotten so far from the U.S. and where do things go from here?
Well, every time there's an escalation, the other side escalates. Recently, the U.S. sent a warship in an area that China specifically said, do not send your ships here. They did that twice. So China now parks these surface-to-air missiles in the middle of the ocean. So no one knows exactly where it's going to go. At this point, China could, say, blow a U.S. drone out of the sky. They could blow a surveillance craft with pilots on it out of the sky, although it's hard to imagine they would be that incendiary. They could also, if there's any Vietnamese spy aircraft flying around there, they could blow that out of the sky. It's not that apparent that they would want to do that because that would really spark intense hostilities. But it's certainly possible if things keep escalating that it gets to that point in the future.
Patrick Nguyen with the World Global Post team, thanks so much.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Marco. Catch you next time.
Here's a story that's literally larger than life. It's about an art studio in North Korea that churns out propaganda murals and banners and all those massive statues of the great leaders. It seems their work, especially the statues with the bold authoritarian poses, are popping up all over Africa. My BBC colleague Lawrence Pollard has been looking into this. So you've written that if your taste in art leads you to want a statue in the classic bronze giant hailing a taxi cab pose, then who are you going to call? Mansu Dae. Tell us, what is Mansu Dae? A style?
It's basically like an art factory. There's 4,000 people that work there. What they produce, if you think of how our lives are surrounded by advertising images and so on, in North Korea, their lives are surrounded by propaganda. And all these images are made by Mansu Dae Art Studios. Now, they don't only make the massive bronzes, the huge heroic statues, the banners. They work in charcoal, in oil, in this thing called crushed jewels, which is semi-precious stones that get crushed up and then put into sort of poster paint. So they do all sorts of things just for North Korea. But they also, and this is the interesting thing, they start making a bit of hard currency, which of course is urgently needed by North Korea, by selling their stuff abroad. And what I was told was that the North Koreans began producing sort of war memorials, you know, big bombastic things. The first one was in Ethiopia, and it was a diplomatic calling card. Now, times have changed since then, and economics has begun to bite North Korea. And what's also happened is the kind of art that you saw in Russia and in China now only really exists in North Korea. So if you want that sort of thing, then that's who you're going to go and ask to do your large bronze statue.
Right. Well, one of the most famous is in Senegal. It's the African Renaissance Monument in Dakar. I've actually seen it. Here's a little taste of the dedication ceremony in 2010.
We have a monument, which is not only a monument for Senegal, not only a monument for Africa, but a monument for black people all over the world.
Wow, that's a lofty language for a statue. As I said, I saw this one. It is so huge, it makes you wonder whether the message is really about North Korean hegemony and less about the Senegalese, even though they're selling it to them. I mean, are those messages still there, do you think?
You do wonder, don't you? It's bigger than the Statue of Liberty. What's interesting is we went out on the streets. People really, really attached to the idea of this is something that we can be proud of. On the other hand, plenty of people saying, really, is this what we want to spend money on? And there was a lot of controversy about whether it was suitable. Senegal, a majority Muslim country, the statue, as you'll know, has a not exactly a semi-naked woman, but she's exposing one of her breasts. And this raises the issue. If it's supposed to celebrate the liberation struggle of many African countries, if it's supposed to put African countries on the map, then why do these statues look suspiciously North Korean? There's one in Kinshasa, which celebrates the assassinated president, Laurent Kabila, the father of the current president. And Kabila looks like he's been shopping for his tunic at the Kim's Pyongyang tailor. You know, it is identifiably an African head, but the body looks just like the giant figures in Pyongyang, as if Mansuda thought, hang on, we'll just put an African head on. And one of the art historians I spoke to said, you know, where are the African artists who are given the chance to do this?
Yeah, right.
Where's the African consciousness? And another guy made an art critic, Bill Fever, made a very amusing comparison. He said, you know what? You might not like them, but it's not that different from Mount Rushmore. Because what the point he was making there is that countries like a particular, quite bombastic, out there, in-your-face, simple style. When they are a young country that wants to establish themselves. And the irony that he was talking about was that by nation building with North Korean art, you end up looking, as you said, rather more North Korean than nationalist.
Lawrence, given that some of these statues are the size of skyscrapers, when you're in Mansudae in Pyongyang, I mean, do they work on like a finger in one studio and a ear in another? And how do they transport all this stuff?
Sometimes the Renaissance in Senegal is a good example. Technicians will travel to the country and they set up a foundry at the bottom of the hills in Dakar in Senegal.
Wow.
So they actually had their own foundry there. They don't always have to do that. There's a very good story of some Germans who wanted to create a replica of 19th century, rather Art Nouveau-y, a fountain which had been destroyed in their city. The only people who could work in that style, what the West would see as a grossly sort of old-fashioned reactionary style, the only people who could do it and would do it with great pleasure for the dollars was North Korea.
The BBC's Lawrence Pollard, thanks so much for telling us these stories.
Marco, my pleasure.
Pope Francis flew to Ciudad Juarez today, the last stop on his trip to Mexico. It was a symbolic choice and highlighted the plight of immigrants by wrapping up the Pope's visit right next to the U.S. border. Over the past 5 days, Francis has spoken to Mexicans repeatedly about doing more to help those in need. But some in Mexico want something else from the Pope, a change in the Church's position on abortion, which is illegal in much of Mexico. The World's Monica Campbell has one woman's story from Juarez.
Mi nombre es Alejandra y soy de Saucillo, Chihuahua.
Alejandra is 27 years old and is a teacher in Ciudad Juarez in the conservative state of Chihuahua. A few years ago, she got married and soon after got pregnant. That's when she faced a hard choice. She asked to use her first name only because she says she hasn't talked about this to anyone before.
Que de repente era muy explosivo. Fuma mucha marihuana, pero todos los días.
Her husband, she says, smoked pot every day, and his anger, rage at times, scared her. Alejandra says she realized she didn't want a child with her husband and didn't want one alone, but abortion just isn't talked about here.
¿Saben que abortaste? Ya eres una mala mujer, como criminal.
She felt like if her family or friends knew she had an abortion, they'd look at her like a criminal. So she did what some women here feel compelled to do, self-induce an abortion alone. She headed to the pharmacy for something she calls a lifeline.
Fui a la farmacia, pedí el misoprostol, supe cómo era el proceso.
She bought misoprostol, pills. The brand name is Cytotec. Alejandra learned about it on the internet. It's meant to treat ulcers, but it can cause an abortion too, a miscarriage, if taken early in a pregnancy. In the U.S., it must be prescribed and can be sold in combo with the morning after pill for an early abortion. But in Mexico, abortion is only legal in Mexico City. Abortion and self-induced abortion is illegal everywhere else. But pharmacies sell it anyway, without a prescription, aware why some women might be buying it. Back home, Alejandra popped several pills.
A las 4 horas, empecé a sangrar, y luego volví a sangrar, volví a sangrar, volví a sangrar.
And says that within 4 hours, she started bleeding, and bleeding, and bleeding, alone in her bathroom. She got worried and went to the hospital, but waiting for the doctor, hooked up to an IV, she got scared. What if the doctor recognized the signs she'd used misoprostol? Alejandra had reason to worry. Last year, a woman was convicted in Juarez for an illegal abortion, and so was the friend who helped her get misoprostol.
Sí hay forma de saber y yo no lo sé.
Alejandra says she took off the IV and left the hospital without treatment, figuring her body would take care of itself. Later, she told her husband, now her ex, she'd miscarried. But women like Alejandra are among the lucky ones, activists here say.
The high rates of maternal mortality due to unsafe abortion in the region convinced me of getting involved in this kind of work. From that moment on, I began to fight the Vatican.
Maria Mejia runs Catholics for the Right to Decide, based in Mexico City, a pro-choice advocacy group. She says Mexican women die from unsafe abortions, but she sees signs that Pope Francis is aware of the problem.
The first one was when he said that the church could not continue to be obsessed with these issues. And then that the church has to change that attitude towards women who have lived the situation of an abortion, because that is a situation where women suffer.
Mejia hopes that more states in Mexico loosen their laws on abortion. But Mejia says abortion is still seen as untouchable in states where conservative parties hold power. For her part, Alejandra says she thought about talking with a priest as she dealt with the aftermath of ending her pregnancy.
Incluso llegué a pensar, oye, voy a meterme a una iglesia y me voy a confesar con algún sacerdote.
But she worried she might get turned into the police or walk away feeling shame, which she says she didn't have about her choice. But back to misoprostol. It worked for Alejandra, but it can be expensive for women here. So some women here can resort to herbs. A popular one is called ruda. Its dried green leaves are sold in a plastic bag. You make a strong tea from it. In a small booth in a market in Juarez, a man sells the herb. He tells me outright, yes, this can end a pregnancy.
¿Y cuánto vale?
It costs about $1.50.
¿Y no hace daño?
I ask if it can be harmful. He says it's natural, but it can trigger bleeding and damage organs if taken in excess. These herbs and even misoprostol show up for sale on both sides of the border here. Alejandra is glad she didn't have to go to the market for that herb, but she says she regrets one thing, giving herself an abortion alone.
Me reclamaba no haberle dicho a una amiga o a alguien que estaba haciendo eso.
She says she wished she'd told someone what she was doing. She thought, here I am bleeding in the bathroom alone. What if something happens and nobody knows? But she feels good talking about all of this now and hopes for a time in Mexico when there's less shame about doing so. For The World, Monica Campbell, Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you've ever lost something on the bus or subway, you know how frustrating that is. Maybe it's nothing more than an umbrella, but what if it's more valuable, like a cell phone or your journal? You probably think it's lost forever, but if you left it on the London Underground, you might be in luck. London's Transit Authority has an office with a tradition of storing and returning your lost property. And as our own Leo Hornack found when he paid a visit, it has a proud caretaker.
Paul Cowan's a man who loves his job. He just can't hide it.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's a pirate umbrella. Isn't that great? I've never seen one like that.
Each day, when he arrives at the London Transport Lost Property Office, no one could be more pleased than Paul to deal with the hundreds upon hundreds of objects left on the city's buses, subways and cabs.
And here we have a range of crutches. Now, crutches fascinate me because I'm thinking, you've got onto the bus or train with some crutches and then you've got off the other end not needing them. Is it some mysterious healing power of the London Transport Network?
We're down in the lowest level of a huge underground warehouse in central London where it's all kept, and Paul is the manager. Picture a sort of subterranean Santa's grotto of orphaned property. At any one time, there are 300,000 lost objects meticulously filed away in this building, each with a charming Paddington Bear-style handwritten label. Every object stays here 3 months before being donated to charity or auctioned off. I'm actually kind of struggling to keep up with Paul here. He spotted something down by the floor.
Feet of a teddy bear sticking out there. I'm wondering if that was a Valentine's gift. It's got a little red bow on it, so might not have ended well on February the 14th for somebody.
Then it's on to hats.
We've got a sort of Mexican
sombrero.
You're now wearing the sombrero.
I'm now wearing the Mexican sombrero. This one's coming from one of our bus garages.
This room has been used for storing lost Valentines and pirate umbrellas and everything else for more than 80 years. And some items take longer to return than others. Paul kept a jar of cremated ashes on his desk for 7 years until eventually it was possible to trace the family and give it back. And he says he can read how this city has changed in the items people leave behind. What London forgets becomes a kind of record of the city's collective fears and obsessions.
We went through the Second World War, so for a long time it was gas masks and helmets and paraphernalia like that. But as fashion's changed, we don't have as much of that. Now when there is a new model phone launched, we can almost time it to within 24 hours before we get our first one in.
You know, there are two ways of looking at these groaning shelves. One is to feel the loss. I mean the emotional loss. All those moments of rising panic when a precious thing was searched for and ended up here instead. 80% of the objects in this warehouse never get back to their owners. But I think there's another, more positive way. Every sombrero, digital camera or iPhone is also a tribute to the honesty and decency of a Londoner who saw that item and passed it on to Paul's team. The biggest cash find to date was £15,000, about $21,000, left on the backseat of a cab. The owner wept when he got that back. And an 80% unclaimed rate also means 20% success. We're by the laptop section here, when Paul tells me he has a message for listeners if they visit London.
Every journey matters, and there's a genuine empathy and a care. The people that use our services are not just paying passengers. And, you know, people may be more honest. You may find that someone who's lost something themselves finds your property and they empathise. They know the pain and they'll hand it in to us to give you the best opportunity to reclaim your property.
For The World, I'm Leo Hornack, Transport for London Lost Property Office, London.
Earlier on The World, I introduced you to Nazanin Danishvar, a young woman in charge of a startup company in Tehran. For our parting shot today, I want to share another surprising story I heard during my visit to Iran's capital about a band that's playing Western-sounding music and getting support from the Iranian regime. The band is called Damai, and 37-year-old bass player Dara Darai is its leader. I met him at a cultural center that looked like a government office from the outside, but inside there was an atrium with parakeets flying freely through the building, and in the back a coffee house that opened onto a garden.
They do some music classes here, some paintings, some theater classes, and also they have a stage over there.
That's Dara Darai, and that stage he mentioned is where he'd be performing later that day with Damai. It was to be a sold-out show. Now, the last time I reported on Tehran's music scene, it was about bands in the city's underground rock scene that were true rebels, making music essentially behind the government's back. For them, it was either that or leave the country. That scene has moved on, it seems, to one where bands like Damai are trying to maintain a sense of artistic integrity in Iran. In the case of Damai, the starting point for their rock, world music, jazz fusion is the little-known music of southern Iran. What's the significance of music from southern Iran? Why is that important? And why did you kind of pick up on that as a kind of a thread?
You know, for me personally, the main thing is the rhythm, the similarities between the rhythm in southern Iranian music and Latin music and Afro music. And this is the main attraction for me to do this project.
Not so long ago, religious authorities in Iran would have simply banned electric, danceable music like the sound of Damai, or at least given the rock aesthetic a lot more scrutiny. But Dara says things are different these days in the Islamic Republic.
You know, Ministry of Guidance in Iran, they really support us to do this project and to make this project happen.
Did they explain why they wanted to support you, why they like you?
I think because we are working on a culture that it might be forgotten for some years ahead, you know?
So Dara Darayi is keeping that culture alive and in the process sending out some fresh new musical vibes to the Iranian public. Seeing Damayi live was memorable, and judging from the audience, Iranians won't forget it either. I'll be sharing more stories from my visit to Tehran all this week on The World. You can see what I saw there on my Instagram feed. That's at Marco Werman. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, thank you for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.